Welcome back again to Bad Quaker Podcast. This is episode 25. Today's sort of a morph between a podcast and an audio article. So I'm naming this Myths of Highways and the Morality of the State. I've got some notes here, so I'll be reading part of this, and I'll be just kind of free-flowing as we go. It's important to judge the things that we believe against known truths and principles. It's not necessary to debunk every state myth. It's kind of like in science. If someone approaches you and says, hey, I have this way to convert lead into gold, and, you know, all I need is these few things, you don't have to stop and start testing the laws of science. You already know that this is not possible, so it's not necessary to debunk each individual myth and reestablish each law of science when you're presented with a fallacy like this. And dealing with the state is very much the same way. Within the minds of the brainwashed masses that are out there, there are so many things that they believe that they've never tested in their life, and that's really the difference between their closed eyes and our open eyes. The problem is, all of us, me included, all of us, we don't have our eyes fully opened to everything that the state has done and all the lies the state has told us and all the myths of the state that exist out there. So the more disciplined we are to be able to take each individual thing that we believe about the state and step back and look at it and say, does this match reality? Does this thing that I've been taught since I was a child, does this thing that seems to make so much sense to me because I've always believed it, does it really match up with reality, or does it have flaws in it? Let me toss out, I have four myths associated with highways and road building and so forth. And I want to toss each of these four myths out, and then I want to give you some information on each one that you can see how, even though these things are fully believed by most of society in the United States today, they're entirely, without foundation. Okay. Myth number one is probably the most popular myth having to do with highways in the U.S. And it really has two versions. It's all focused around Eisenhower, the great, great, great Eisenhower that we're all supposed to just bow at his statues. Eisenhower, supposedly, and there, like I said, there's two versions of this, so I'll have a version A and a version B. Eisenhower was so impressed by version A, the Autobahns in Germany, that he wanted the United States to be crisscrossed with highways for the purpose of troop movements, for defensive purposes to defend the United States in case of an invader. That's version A of the myth. Version B of the myth is that Eisenhower is so impressed with the Lincoln Highway being Carl Fisher's highway system that was a private highway that was built, that stretched coast to coast in, like, 19, I think they started, like, around, oh, well, let me just look real quick. This is why I have notes. Okay, so the Lincoln Highway was completed in 1913, stretching coast to coast, connecting Times Square in New York City to Lincoln Park in San Francisco. Originally, it went through 13 states, and this was developed and funded very ingeniously by Carl Fisher. Initially, he made a fortune selling auto parts. That was his interest in getting the highway system built. But then also, he was a land speculator and a real estate speculator. So the myth goes that Eisenhower, and this part is true, Eisenhower was part of a military, a sort of a publicity stunt for the Lincoln Highway, where they took a troop of military individuals, and they went cross-country, and it was a big deal, And so the myth is that Eisenhower was so impressed by the ability to drive coast to coast on the Lincoln Highway that when he became president, he wanted this national highway system put into place. I'm gonna go through the four myths, and then I'll come back and list them 1, 2, 3, 4, and debunk them. So I'm not gonna debunk that yet. So we have the myth number one: Eisenhower was so impressed by fill in the road, either the Autobahns or the Lincoln Highway, according to who the teller of the tale is, that he wanted the country crisscrossed with these highways for the purpose of troop movements, for defensive reasons. Okay, that's myth one. Myth two: Hitler, you know, that mad genius that we're all told about, designed the Autobahns and the Volkswagen. I'll get to that in a minute. Hitler designed the Autobahns and the Volkswagen. Myth three: without the state, all roads would be toll roads. How often are we told this? Well, we can't privatize the roads. They'll all be toll roads. I don't want to pay toll roads. I don't want toll roads. We'll get to that. Four: private roads were tried and they failed due to the lack of maintenance. That's a popular myth. We'll get to that one too. That's number four. Okay, so let's deal with number one. Number one was Eisenhower, the Eisenhower myth. This is simply a lie. It was made up in the 50s to garner funding for the highway projects of the 50s. I have no doubt that Eisenhower was probably impressed when he drove across the Lincoln Highway. Who wouldn't be? I have no doubt that Eisenhower wasn't impressed, was impressed by the Autobahns in Germany. Who wouldn't be? They're magnificent today. I would love to go to Germany today and go and drive on the Autobahns. That would be thrilling. I'd love that. But that was made up for the purpose of funding the highway system in the 50s. It finally passed in 1956, and it was this huge scam that it was supposed to be paid off within a very specific time frame, and of course they failed to accomplish the amount of pavement that they were supposed to put down, the amount of miles that they were supposed to have done. They did not come in anywhere near budget. They had to refinance it again. They didn't even completely pay for what they had already expended, so they had to roll that back over. It's kind of like if you buy a house and you only make 3 or 4 payments, and then you go and you refinance the house again, and you only make 3 or 4 payments, or maybe a year's worth of payments, and you refinance the house again. If you do this, eventually you will owe far more than your original contract on the house, because all you're doing is paying on the interest of the debt and never actually paying on the debt. And each time you're building up a bigger and a bigger amount that you've paid without ever putting any money on the principal of the debt. So this is kind of what happened with the highway systems. We started in the 50s, and there was a very hard line. Congress will do this and this and this, and the roads will be built like this. And then a new Congress comes in. They're not bound by the rules of the old Congress, and so they just refinance the thing, and they refinance it, and they refinance it. Our grandchildren, who are as many are not even born today, will still be paying on the highway systems the money that never got paid off in the 50s, never got paid off in the 60s, never got paid off in the 70s. It just keeps getting refinanced and put back on the loan again. They're still not paid off, and they're not completed. And have you driven on one lately? Okay. So the myth that Eisenhower wanted this cross-country system for troop movement and for defensive reasons, and he wanted that because of his experience on the Lincoln Highway or the Autobahns. Now, the problem with this is that was in the 1950s, 1956, when the highway bill was passed and they began funding them under Eisenhower. The problem is, in the United States, the state first attempted a national road system in, are you sitting down? 1811. 1811 was the first attempt at a national road system. At the time, they were using the McAdam method, which was a big innovation of its day. But the problem was that the government, the federal government, the state, could not consistently fund the project. So even though they did build a major highway for its day back in the time, the name of that, let me look here. That was just called the National Road. It was also called the Cumberland Road. It cut from the Potomac River to Vandalia, Illinois, across parts of Pennsylvania, West Virginia, Ohio, Indiana, and Illinois. And they did build it, or they worked on it from like 1811 to 1818, when they, over a matter of like 7 years, they were able to build this highway. Now, when I say it was on the macadam method, that's basically a gravel road. It was a specific type of road building that involved specific sizes of gravel. And here's the beauty of the macadam road. Macadam was a Scotsman that was a state employee, and he worked on highways and so forth in the UK. This was in the early 1800s. And he came to the conclusion that what you needed was a consistent, not big stones, like if you can imagine the Appian Highway was made by fitting together very meticulously large stones that fit very, very snugly, and they don't move much. So the wear and tear on these big stones is just however much a wheel rolling across the stone produces. But his system was one of a lot of small stones and layers of different sizes of stones. And by doing it like this, the stones would sort of interlock among themselves. The more you drove on it, the more you drove the wagons and horses and so forth of the day, the better compacted it became and the better the road became. And so rather than having the ruts that you typically see of a dirt road, where there's a rut right where one wheel always runs, and then there's a high berm in the middle and another rut where the other set of wheels run, instead of having that, which was classic of a dirt road with wagons going across it, the macadam gave you a stable surface that didn't produce ruts, or at least didn't tend to produce ruts the way that a dirt road did, and it dissipated the water better than other methods of the day. So from 1811 to 1818, the National Road was built across that area, and part of it cut through modern-day West Virginia, but I think I left that out earlier. But either way, the problem was that, as handy as it was to have this road going into the new, that was the new West in those days, you know, Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, that was considered the Northwest Territory at the time. The problem with that was that the federal government couldn't keep its act together and keep the thing funded, so the government road was never properly maintained, and eventually the federal government just gave it up, and they gave it to the individual states with the hope that the individual states could maintain it. And of course, part of it they were able to, and part of it they weren't. But the point here being that it was the state's failure with the one and only road system that they had tried in 1811 that needs to be made a note of, and I'll come back to that in a minute. So we're told in 1956 that Eisenhower had this great idea, and that's why the federal government got into road building, when in fact the federal government got into road building and failed in 1811. Then the state socialized existing successful private highway systems in 1926. There were a wide variety of successful highway systems. There was the Lincoln Highway that I mentioned earlier that was built by Carl Fisher, and he built several other highways. If memory serves me correctly, he built the Dixie Highway as well, that went from the Gulf Coast to Canada. But there was a wide variety of roads. There were lots of highways that were privately built and privately maintained, and they were good highways. And in 1926, you know, here's the thing with the state. Anytime the state gets its eye on something that is good and successful, it desires that, because theft is one of the natures of the state. So in 1926, there was a very successful, good highway system, not based on macadam, not a gravel road. This was modern paved highways. So the state saw that, and so it stole it. It socialized, the federal government socialized the highways, 1926. And then from 1926 all the way through the Roaring Twenties and into the Great Depression, and all the way through the Great Depression till the beginning of World War II, the state continually tried to develop a highway system. But because the United States is so massive and large, you know, in Germany in the 1930s, building an autobahn across Germany east to west, not a big accomplishment. I mean, they had all the resources available, they had the manpower available, they had the technology available. It wasn't a big deal. Keeping in mind that building a highway across Germany east to west, and we're not talking about trying to get up into the Alps with the thing, but east to west, building a road system or a highway system across Germany is about like building a highway system across Ohio and Indiana. That's very different from, say, building a highway system from Kansas City to San Francisco, or, you know, from Portland to Portland, Portland, Maine to Portland, Oregon. Or let's say you're going to build a highway system from just within one state. You take California. If you're going to build a highway system from Los Angeles to San Francisco, you have two paths. One is along the coastal highway, which is extremely unstable, and the state has been attempting to keep a highway there now for a very long time, and it still crumbles into the ocean on a regular basis. And the other method is going up through the San Joaquin Valley, the Central Valley of California. The problem with going through the San Joaquin Valley is you have two massive mountain passes to try to get through. One down at what's called the Grapevine between Los Angeles and Bakersfield, and the other is up where Pacheco Pass cuts across to take you from the San Joaquin Valley over into, if you're headed into San Jose in that area. If we have any listeners in California, you're nodding your head right now if you've ever passed across the Pacheco Pass or the Grapevine. Now consider that, I won't go into those two passes for right now. Right now, today, as of today, the highway system's pretty good in California, but we'll get into that in a minute. So let's assume part of this is true. Let's assume that somehow Eisenhower was impressed or whatever, and so Eisenhower, that's why he was convinced. He wanted a highway system for troop movement. Let's just assume that part of the myth is true. By 1956, moving troops by use of trucks and highways was already completely outdated. If that myth is true, then Eisenhower was guilty of the classic stupidity of generals and politicians, and that is to fight the current war using the technology and the methods of the last war. Yes, in World War II, massive amounts of men were moved by truck. But by the time 1956 rolled around, we got funding, we started on the highway systems. The very next confrontation that we got into was Vietnam, and Vietnam was a war where we moved our troops by flying them there. We didn't build a road to Vietnam. Now, even today, if we have a large amount of troops in San Diego, and we need to get them to, let's say, San Francisco, they're probably going to fly. Unless they're naval or Marines, in which case they'll probably go by ship, if that's part of the process, if that's part of the training or the action or whatever that's taking place. Today, troop movements are done by air. They're not done by highway. So if the myth is true that it was his design to make a defensive action to defend the United States by having this highway system, then he was guilty of fighting the last war, fighting the current war with the last war's technology and methods. But here's the problem with that idea. You see, when the American troops and when the Allied troops, the Canadian troops and the English troops and the Australian troops, when they broke the German lines in Germany, sure, there was some movement through through non-highway forms. But when they actually broke the lines and they got into Germany itself, whether it was the Soviet troops on the Eastern Front or whether it was the other Allied troops on the Western Front, when they got to the Autobahns, guess who the Autobahns helped? They helped the invading forces of Germany as much as they helped the defending forces of Germany. And the same is the case in a theoretical situation with the United States. If some theoretical enemy were to be foolish enough to try to attack us on a land war in the United States, which has never, ever, ever happened and could never happen, that's a ridiculous concept, but if some enemy did decide that they wanted to attack the United States in a land war, the highway system would be as much to the invader's advantage as it would be to the defender's advantage. So if that myth of Eisenhower is true, then Eisenhower was a moron and an idiot and knew nothing about military. So which is it going to be? Was Eisenhower a great visionary who lied about the reason for the highways to be built? He had some other reason. Maybe he was for commerce, or maybe he was for development of the suburbs, and he just lied to the American people and used the excuse that, oh yeah, yeah, that's going to be good for troop movement. Is that what we're to believe? Or are we to believe that he was a good-hearted man but an idiot? Either way, I don't like the result. Okay, let's go to the next one. Hitler. The next myth was Hitler. Hitler, this mad genius, designed the Autobahns and the Volkswagen. Okay. Well, first off, why do we make great men out of monsters? Whether we're talking about Hitler, Napoleon, Lincoln, Caesar, Eisenhower, why do we make great men out of these people? Why do we have this need? In the case of someone like Hitler, we know how evil he was, and yet there's this tendency for teachers to say, well, yes, but you know, he did this, or you know, he built the Autobahns, you know, he kept employment, and Stalin, well, Stalin was evil, sure, he killed millions of people, but you know, the trains ran on time. Why do we feel the need to do that? Why do we feel the need to justify these monsters? Hitler was not a mad genius. Hitler was a childish, spoiled, angry, little, damaged man. That's the best thing I can say about him. He was a foolish, spoiled little child. The technology all existed already to build concrete highways and overpasses and continuous flows, interchanges. That technology already existed. Additionally, the designs already existed. There had been, going all the way back into the 20s, there had been utopian designers, there had been utopian movies, there had been utopian authors writing books about utopian cities where these continuous flow intersections and bypasses all seamlessly moved traffic in and out of the cities. And all this utopian stuff already existed in design form. All the technology to build the roads in the way that they were built in Germany and in the Autobahn, all that technology existed. Do we praise Hitler because he essentially went in and used, I'll get to this in a minute and justify what I'm about to say, but he essentially used slave labor and stolen money to build a highway system in an attempt to keep his economy going? This is based on the broken window fallacy. This is the same thing Napoleon tried to do when he would have his soldiers digging ditches and then filling them back in again. Or then he would take his soldiers out to dig ditches to drain lands to produce farmlands. Except the overall product of what they were doing was wasted effort and wasted time. And Bastiat goes into enough detail on that I don't have to take it all back to task again. Either way, all this nationalistic effort that Napoleon did was a net waste of money. in the long run. And this is exactly the case with Hitler. Hitler wasted national treasure in order to get his road system in because he thought it would bring more prosperity to the nation based on the idiotic Keynesian economics that Hitler built his government on. Okay, I'm not going to go in that direction. Okay, so have we covered Hitler? Oh, no. The other half of that myth, Hitler, half of the myth is that Hitler designed the Autobahns. The other half is that Hitler designed the Volkswagen. Hitler did not design the Volkswagen. Ferdinand Porsche, the genius, the actual genius, Ferdinand Porsche, designed the Volkswagen. Hitler just used the force of the state to come in and swoop in and take credit and say, build so many of these, and then he usurped Porsche's factories and started building tanks, so that Porsche couldn't even make money that he needed to make by selling cars. He had to shift his production and start making tanks instead. So that entire myth about Hitler, first, he's not a mad genius. He's just an evil monster and a spoiled brat. Two, he did not design the Autobahns. He basically used the broken window fallacy in trying to correct his economy. Three, he did not design the Volkswagen. Ferdinand Porsche was the real genius and designed the Volkswagen. All he did was usurp Porsche's factory and start building tanks there. Okay, third, the third myth. Without the state, all roads would be toll roads. Okay. The vast majority of private roads have never been toll. Let me say that again. The vast majority of private roads have never been toll. The vast majority of toll roads have always been state roads. Think about the roads that you're aware of. Think about the roads. If you live in the U.S., think about turnpikes, the whole turnpike system. Think about toll roads. Anytime you can think of a toll road, it's either owned one of two ways. It's either owned by the state. And again, let me redefine state. State, in the United States, we get this fuzzy idea of what is a state and what is not a state. And there's like the state of Nebraska and the state government in Washington, D.C. State is one entity, and it's worldwide. And the state is that entity which uses force and aggression and lies to maintain a monopoly of power and a monopoly on law. And it's geographically based. So a geographically based monopoly on force, on law, on taxation, that's the state. So I'm not distinguishing between the state of Montana and the state that operates out of Washington, D.C. It's all the state. It's the same monster. So if you think about actual toll roads that you know of existing, almost all of them are either owned by, for my knowledge, I don't know of any toll roads that don't fit this category. So there may be a toll road out there that's privately owned that doesn't fit this category, but I'm not aware of it. Every toll road I'm aware of is either owned and operated by the state, or is or was owned and operated by the state and is simply contracted by a corporation and is run by a corporation under a fascist model, which is still the state. You see, when a corporation is authorized by the state to have a specific monopoly on something, then it's still the state. When AT&T controlled all communications within the United States, there was no distinction between AT&T, the corporation, and the state. They were an arm of the state. This is something that's very confusing for a lot of libertarians, and even a lot of anarchists get confused about this. Corporations, when corporations are given a monopoly and given court protection by the state, they are simply a part of the state, and they have to be viewed that way. Okay. Let's see, where were we? Okay, now think of the roads around your house. Think of the roads that you know of that are locally, that are privately owned. And your first thought is like, well, I don't know of any privately owned roads. Have you seen a parking lot? If you're in an area where there's a lot of snow, I'm here in Ohio, we get a lot of snow. In Ohio, when we have a sudden, unexpected, and violent snowstorm that rushes in on us, here's what happens. The state is generally sluggish to respond. They generally don't get the salt out on the roads quick enough. They generally don't plow quick enough. And generally, especially if the storm hits in the middle of the night, in the morning, the state takes hours before it gets caught up to the snow emergency. So everything's delayed for hours in the morning. But here's the odd part. Let's say a snowstorm hits Ohio, where I live, western Ohio, in the middle of the night on a Tuesday morning, let's say, at 5 o'clock in the morning. If you wake up at 5 when the snowstorm is hitting, and you get in your car and you go and you look around and you kind of observe what's happening, what you'll see is a lot of private trucks, just pickup trucks, big pickup trucks with a snowplow on the front, driving very quickly to get someplace. Now, they're not plowing the roads that they're driving on. They're driving on state roads, but they're rushing to parking lots and private streets, privately owned streets. Because the owners of the parking lots and the owners of the private streets pay them to maintain those streets. So when the state snow trucks finally start rolling, the parking lots are already clean. The private streets are already clean. And what am I talking about, private streets? Well, private communities that maintain their own streets. These are generally gated communities or upper-level communities where a homeowners association owns and maintains the streets. Those streets are clean hours before the state streets are clean. And the reason why is because the market makes sure they're clean. The state has no incentive. The state doesn't care if you're 2 hours late for work. The state doesn't care if all the school buses run 2 hours late. The state doesn't care. But the owner of a parking lot who knows he does no business at all if his customers can't safely park in his parking lot and walk across the parking lot and get to his business. That guy has an incentive to hire a guy who also has an incentive to get down there before the snow gets bad and get on top of the plowing. So private roads, look around your house, are things like parking lots and streets that are privately owned, like within gated communities. Streets within apartment complexes that are privately owned. Not federally subsidized, not state subsidized apartment complexes. Privately owned. Those are maintained. Okay, now let's think of myth number four. Private roads were tried and failed due to the lack of maintenance. Now, this is really laughable. Because, do you remember the first road that I was talking about, the first highway system in the United States in 1811 that used the macadam method, which was a gravel-type method? That was abandoned by the federal government because they couldn't consistently fund it and they couldn't consistently maintain it. And yet, private road, that was 1811 to 1818, private highways and roads continued to be built and maintained all through the 1800s in the U.S. And when the technology changed and it was no longer buggies and horses that were driving on these roads, macadam method of gravel was no longer useful. Automobile tires, because they move at a faster rate because of the width of them and because of the nature of how the tire works, it squishes when it goes, when it rolls across the pavement. It creates a vacuum that literally sucks the dust up out of a gravel road, and it sucks up as the tire rotates. It creates a suction that lifts, if you've ever watched a car going rapidly down a gravel road, you will see it whipping dust up into the air with great violence. And the reason why is because there are super fast turbulences of air right where that tire is lifting off the gravel that just suck the dust right up into the, into a vortex that whips it into the air. So this that mechanical activity that takes place with the air and with that vacuum and with the dust destroys a macadam paved road. So the technology had to change, and the change came in technology first with the development of what is called tarmac, which is not the thing at the airport. That's mislabeled, by the way. Tarmac is not used at the airport. That's a mislabeling of something. That it's like people that call their refrigerator a Frigidaire when it's actually a GE because they're used to saying Frigidaire or Icebox. It's like people calling their refrigerator Icebox. Really, it's an Icebox. It's cooled by a large chunk of ice that a guy in a wagon delivered. It's not an Icebox. It's a refrigerator. Anyway, that's the same with... calling that section of paved area at the airport a tarmac. It's not a tarmac. Tarmac was a specific type of road construction. So when tarmac developed, now you could have a oil-based substance that was placed on the macadam that sealed the top of it, and that was better than just the bare macadam. Let me see if I have a note on that. No, I don't. I didn't look up the other. Later development, when they left tarmac behind, tarmac was a coal oil based substance that was sprayed on top of existing macadam, existing gravel roads. So as the development continued and as asphalt became a waste product of the oil industry, it was discovered that mixing gravel and asphalt together produced a better surface for road building than using a macadam sprayed over with a tarmac. So now we have an asphalt pavement rather than a tarmac or a macadam pavement. Now that all developed independently of the state. And so in the early 1900s, when this new pavement style was adopted, they were able to build roads that were not destroyed by the car tires as they rolled across it, because it dealt with that vacuum problem that I was talking about. So let's see, where are we? So the maintaining of the roads was done throughout the 1800s and into the early 1900s by private individuals and by private companies. When the state took over, when the state socialized the roads in 1926, the technology had already changed without the influence of the state, so that you didn't have the maintenance problems that you had in the 1800s. It made it that much easier for the state to function. However, if you've driven across the United States, and I'm sure the same exists in other countries, but if you drive across the United States today, what you'll find is really bad roads. Especially, it seems, the closer you get to a big city, the worse the roads get. Recently I drove through Dayton, Ohio, through Indianapolis, Indiana, through St. Louis, Illinois, and then back again through all those. And the roads were horrific, terrible, downright dangerous. And there's constant maintenance going on in all those cities. I made the same trip a year ago, and there was constant maintenance going on in exactly the same locations with exactly the same results going through those exact same cities. Nothing changed. Several years prior to that, I went down those same roads through those same cities, and the result was the same. There was constant construction going on in those cities on the same spots in the same areas. It never changes, and there's a reason why. State roads, the whole process is riddled with graft, corruption, nepotism, crony deal-making. Individual local politicians utilize the waste of government to grab federal funding and then keep their relatives and keep their friends and keep their political allies busy and keep the companies, the corporations that those people own, keep them funded in constant road maintenance that never, never, never ends. As long as there's a supply of free tax money, the road construction will never, ever, ever end. And this is a good time to get back to why we know that things are like this. We don't have to debunk the myths of the roads. We don't have to debunk the myths of the highway system and of Eisenhower and of Hitler and all these myths that involve these people. We don't have to debunk these things. If in your mind, if you can keep in your thoughts that it's important to judge the things that we believe against known truths and principles, it's not necessary to debunk every state myth. This is like what I was talking about science a minute ago. If someone says, hey, I can levitate, then you don't have to immediately begin testing the laws of physics and of the laws of gravity, and you don't have to. You can immediately know it's a trick. You're either lying to me or you're doing a trick. You're not levitating. The same thing with the state. We don't have to go through and dissect every single myth. If you can get it in your mind that if what's being pushed on me by the media, the mainstream media, by schools, by anyone involved, corporations, advertising coming from corporations, if these things don't fit these basic truths and principles that we've already established that we know is true, then it's fake. I don't need to debunk every single one. I can just spot the fake, and I don't have to know the whole history of why it's fake. I don't have to take it apart and prove it's fake. As soon as the state speaks through one of its many mouths, media, corporations, whatever, as soon as it speaks, Al Gore opens his mouth, nonsense comes out, I know he's lying. How do I know he's lying? Because he's a mouth of the state. He has no choice. So let's get to those principles. Let's get to those known truths. Bad cannot produce a net good. Example. I take a gun out of my pocket. I stick it to someone's head. I rob them of their wealth. Then I take that money. I go across town and I feed the homeless. I don't keep any for myself. Can doing this evil thing justify the good? Can the good that I do justify the evil that I have done? If a person can balance this question in their mind and they can say, yes, it's good to rob that guy because you're doing something good with the money, then you've got a flaw, you've got a moral flaw in your thinking, and I'm not sure I can help you. If you realize that the ultimate result, not the one you see, the ultimate result of robbing from one guy to give to someone else, if you can understand that that is immoral, and even if you can't see the bad part that happens, and even if you do see what appears to be good as the result, if you understand that somewhere in the balance of things, that evil act has produced more evil than it produced good, if you understand that, then you can begin to apply that principle to everything you face in regards to the state. And the state will always fail the test. The state will always produce more evil than it produces good. Sometimes the state produces good, but it will never produce as much good as the evil that it has produced through its theft and its violence and its lies. So, when we begin to weigh things, like, for instance, the highways, I don't I don't have to, in my own mind, I don't have to go through and prove every aspect of highway production, every aspect of highway development, every aspect of highway maintenance. I don't have to go through and prove all those things to myself to realize if the state goes in and confiscates the roads, as they did in 1926 in the U.S., and they begin building roads and they begin maintaining roads, I can just assume that they're not doing it right. Now, specifically, let's think of it like this. Which is a more efficient use of money? If we have a voluntary exchange between buyers and sellers of goods and services? Or is it more efficient use of money to have legislation deciding on taxation levels, followed by bureaucratic collections of the taxes, followed by legislative decisions on spending those taxes, followed by bureaucratic contracting through the distribution to service providers, so the bureaucrats then take those tax monies and distribute it to service providers and product suppliers to eventually produce the end result. Which of these is more efficient? The voluntary exchange between buyers and sellers of goods and services? Or the layers of legislation, taxation, and bureaucratic nonsense that go with the state? So let's boil it down to something more simple. I want an apple. There's a man who has an apple tree and he sells apples. I go to him and I say, I'd like an apple. He says, they cost a dollar each. I say, I don't want to pay a dollar each. I'll pay 50 cents. He says, that's a good deal. We make an exchange. I have an apple. He has 50 cents. Neither of us is harmed. He profits in this situation by 50 cents. I profit by an apple. Or the government could decide that apples are needed, so it could rob from someone to get enough money to pay someone to plant apple trees and raise apples. Then, not even mentioning that Mises has shown that there's no price mechanism when the state starts to do this, so that there's no way to tell what the real value of the apple is. In the first one, I knew what the apple value was for me. It's worth 50 cents. The apple seller was hoping to get a dollar, but he also knew that the real value was less than a dollar, and he was willing to take 50 cents. So in that exchange, the value of the dollar is worth, the value of the apple is worth 50 cents. However, in a different situation where I've already bought one apple and he's trying to sell me another one for 50 cents, I don't want another one. So he might say, hey, you want a second one for a quarter? And I might take a second one for a quarter. Or it might be that a second apple is not worth a quarter to me because I've already got a first one. And all I really need is one. So the buyer and the seller can figure out the exchange and they can figure out the price value almost naturally without any real effort. But the state has no way to do that. In any kind of socialistic situation, you have no price mechanism. So once the state steals the money to develop the apple orchard, it has no way of determining what the individual apples should be priced at. So it's either going to price them ridiculously high, ridiculously low, or perhaps it might accidentally price them correctly. Either way, now it's got to find a seller. So you have to get bureaucrats to go and try to convince people to buy the apples. Well, now you're exchanging the commodities through bureaucratic exchange. You're going to have legislation to figure out what really is an apple. They've got to decide, what are we going to call an apple? All these levels of bureaucratic and legislation activity take effort, whereas the buyer and the seller in their first example, it all happened naturally. When the state tries to do the same activity, each level, each hand that has to hand the tax money to another hand, each department that it goes through, all consume part of that until they have used up, by their very existence, the apple and the dollar. And they still haven't produced an apple or a dollar. This is what the state does. It constantly consumes. And if by chance an apple grows, it's strictly by chance. It is not because the state is in any way better at producing apples than the buyer and the seller. So as we understand these principles and we apply them to each and everything that we face with the state, we can begin to see the myths and the lies of the state. I was going to go into why road building from the state is forced labor, even when people think they're employed. I was going to go into that, but I'm not going to. I was going to, Robert Nozick did in his book Anarchy, State, and Utopia, in his book Anarchy, State, and Utopia, laid out nine, what he called the tale of the slave. And he laid out nine levels of slavery, and then he asked a question at the end of that. And I was going to go through that nine levels of slavery and then ask that question and then show that, in fact, all highway building, when done by the state, is actually slave labor. I was going to do that, but I'm going to hold that for another episode. Thanks very much for listening. I do appreciate any feedback that you have, any questions you might have. You can put them on the website at badquaker.com, or you feel free to email me, ben@badquaker.com. If you have a problem with the website, be sure and drop a note to the admin. That's badquaker@badquaker.com. And, as always, for more articles and podcasts on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com. And thank you for listening.